Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And Leo.
And tonight we're going to bring you some news, and after we do that, we will bring you an interview with Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for AFSCME Council 4 here in Connecticut. And he's going to, he brought us up to date on some health care issues and some issues pertinent to Connecticut and to the union here in Connecticut.
Yeah, I don't know if it's, I forgot to ask him if it was statewide, and just statewide or nationwide, with their negotiations with the Red Cross.
I think it's just the Red Cross here in Connecticut that they're negotiating with, but they have other difficulties nationwide with the Red Cross.
Yeah, they're doing the same thing.
Yeah, but he's just negotiating. AFSCME is negotiating here in Connecticut the contract.
But anyway, Larry's going to be on later, and we got a couple articles we'd like to read. We will.
This is an interesting one. It's from the petitionsite.com.
It's
sad.
Very, very sad.
And you can go to this site and sign the petition. It's Stop the Calderon Dolphin Slaughter in Denmark.
And that's the petition.
I just said this petition. I just read that, Leo.
Oh, you did?
Yes. Okay. Stop the Calderon Dolphin Slaughter in Denmark. And every year in Denmark, specifically in the Farp Islands, innocent and helpless Calderon dolphins are slaughtered brutally by the Danes. Why, you may ask? Simply because. A pointless and stupid rite of passage to manhood. What point is there in killing another living being just to prove you have evolved, you have transcended? There is simply no need. These poor dolphins are stabbed a number of times, but as if that weren't enough, they bleed to death, probably in excruciating pain, while the whole town watches. Needless to say, the killing of a defenseless animal is no proof of anybody's manhood.
And, please go to that site. I think that's absolutely...
That's the petitionsite.com, and you can sign that petition, and hopefully when they see the outrage, they'll stop it.
And the thing is, dolphins are so manly and friendly. They're, you probably bait them, and they go right up to them, and they jump on them and stab them to death. I mean, this is some kind of a old Viking,
rite of passage.
Rite of passage.
Ridiculous.
I mean,
the dolphin is such a tame creature. Why don't they jump on a shark and show how manly they are?
Yeah, jump on a shark, you cowardly sons of thieves.
Jump on a tiger shark or a great white. Then we'll see how manly you are.
Yeah, so much for the manhood of the Danish people. Man, that is one sick practice, buddies. And the whole town watches them do it. It is one sick sucker of a town. All right, anyway. let's move on. God, that made me sick when I read that.
This is from the Columbia Journalism Review. Do doctors always tell the truth? Kudos to the Journal Centennial and reporter John Farber for digging up the difference between fact and fiction when it comes to medical researchers at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. At least 9 doctors there told the medical journals which published their research findings that they had no conflict of interest in companies that figured into their work. After digging into university records, the Journal Centennial uncovered a different story. Meet Manesha Mehta, one of the university's cancer specialists. Mehta co-authored an article about tomotherapy, a radiation therapy system developed by researchers at the university. In March, the Journal of Radiation Oncology Biology Physics published his research, which assessed 3,800 treatments using the therapy. In July 2008, the Journal of Radiation received Mehta's paper. It received a revised revision in November, which was accepted for publication a week later. In the published article, Mehta did not reveal his financial ties to the manufacturer of the radiation technology, although the other authors did. The newspaper discovered that less than 2 months before Mejia sent his research findings to the Journal of Radiation, he told the university that he had just started working as a consultant to Tomotherapy Incorporated, a Wisconsin-based firm that makes the systems, and he was reducing his workload at the university. He disclosed that his compensation would exceed $20,000, along with stock options then valued at less than $10,000. The Journal Centennial reported that in 2008, Mejia received consulting income from the company totaling $75,000 for 20 days of work. His stock options climbed in value between $10,000 and $20,000. The paper found other similar examples and noted a lack of disclosure in several high-profile national cases has undermined the integrity of the medical field. Disclosure, it is said, alerts doctors and others who read medical journals to potential bias and allows them to weigh the credibility and value of the articles. In other words, disclosure tells practicing doctors whether some new intervention is worth trying on their patients, and it can help patients learn if their doctors are doing what helps them as opposed to helping technology makers get richer. The press needs to be the watchdog for these sorts of conflicts of interest and let the public know about them. The Journal Centennial did the kind of connect-the-dot reporting that's so rare these days. The story explored the complicity of the medical journals themselves and pointed out that disclosure comes in different stripes, that those narrowly define what is conflict and those that are vague and incomplete. As an example, it cited the fuzzy disclosure practices of various orthopedic surgery journals. The Journal Centennial story is significant. It shows that despite all the hand-wringing rhetoric from journal editors, the professional associations, and others about full or better disclosure, the doctor still likes to bend the rules. It also shows that good reporting from regional newspapers is not yet dead. These kinds of stories used to be the bread and butter fare at regional papers known for good reporting in Milwaukee, Detroit, Des Moines, and Cleveland. We hope the Journal Centennial continues to dig and others will do the same, keeping an eye on the academic medical centers in your own backyard, and the docs who work there can make for some great local reporting.
And that's, you can tell them where you got that one. There's a lot of good articles. This is Mercola, I think, isn't it?
No, this is by Trudy Lieberman. The article is from cjr.org/campaign-.
Columbia Journal Review.
Yeah.
But cjr.org.
Strong Press, Strong Democracy.
cjr.org.
Yeah.
And I got one here. This is kind of interesting. This is hundreds attend vigil outside Lieberman's home over health care. In Connecticut here the other day, quietly holding candles, hundreds of clergymen, congregants, and reform advocates lined the sidewalks outside independent U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman's Stanford home Sunday night in a show of support for universal health care. And I thought that was pretty good. There's an opinion by that I wanted to read by New York Times opinion op-ed, but it was written by Bob Herbert, and I thought it was kind of good. President Obama's strongest supporters during the presidential campaign are the young, the black, and the poor. They are among those who are being hammered unmercifully in this long and cruel economic turndown that the financial elites are telling us is over. If the elites are correct, if the Great Recession really is over, then these core supporters of the president are being left far, far behind, as are blue-collar workers of every ethnic and political persuasion. Nobody wants to talk seriously about class in America, but elites are smiling and perusing their stock portfolios while the checklist of Americans locked in depression-like circumstances just grows and grows. Construction and manufacturing workers, young men without college degrees, especially young black and Hispanic men, teenagers, and those who were already poor when the recession began. And the economic environment for all of these groups is an absolute and utter disaster. Now we're learning the unmarried women, that unmarried women are among those being crushed by the epidemic of joblessness. As the Center of American Progress has noted, the high unemployment rate of unmarried women, and particularly the 1.3 million unemployed female heads of households who are primary breadwinners for their families, is devastating to their financial circumstances and standard of living. Mr. Obama announced this week that he would convene a job summit at the White House next month to explore ways of putting Americans back to work. It remains to be seen whether the summit will yield anything substantial, but it's fair to wonder why the president and his party have not been focused like fanatics on job creation from the first day he took office. It was the financial elites who took the economy down, and it was ordinary working people, that longtime natural constituents of the Democratic Party, who were buried in who were buried in the rubble. And Mr. Obama and the Democrats have been unconscionably slow in riding to the rescue of those millions of Americans struggling with the curse of joblessness. We've been hearing that there are 6 unemployed workers for every job opening in the U.S., but even the terrible figure is deceptive. There are 25 unemployed construction workers for every job opening in their field, and more than a dozen for every opening in the durable goods industries, according to the Center for Labor Market Studies at the Northeastern University in Boston. This was not a normal recession, and we are not in the cusp of anything like a normal recovery. The unemployment rate for black Americans is 15.7%. The underemployment rate for blacks in September, the last month for which figures were available, was a gut-wrenching 23.8%. And for Hispanics, and even worse, 25.1%. The poverty rate for black children is almost 35%. Wall Street can boast about recovery all it wants, but much of America remains trapped in economic hell. It will be a monumental leadership effort by the administration and Congress to spark the kind of changes necessary to transform this wretched employment landscape. And Ross Eisenberry of the Economic Policy Institute has written, "By itself, the private sector is unable to create jobs in the numbers the United States needs to obtain a robust, full economic recovery. If that's true, and I have long believed it to be the case, then we need to rethink our entire approach to employment. Conventional efforts to kickstart economic growth are dwarfed by the vast scale of the problems, and bold new efforts, creative efforts, are needed." And a recent survey for the Policy Institute found that 1 in 4 families have been hit by a job loss during the past year. 44% had suffered either the loss of a job or reduction in wages or hours worked. And economic insecurity has spread like a debilitating virus through scores of millions of American families. What kind of recoveries are we talking about if the blue-collar workers and men and women without college degrees and large percentage of ethnic minorities and the young and the poor are not part of it? And how can any recovery be sustained if economic insecurity is a permanent feature of even middle-class life? And the financial elites have flourished in the recent decades to a great extent because they have had government on their side, with the politicians working diligently to ensure that rules, regulations, and tax policies established an environment in which the elites could thrive. For ordinary Americans, it has been a different story. The jobs shipped overseas by the millions, and wages remaining stagnant, with labor unions under constant assault and labor standards weakened, with this safety net shredded and the message sent out to workers everywhere, "You're on your own." Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get a chance to see if at President Obama's employment summit whether anything much has changed. And that is an op-ed by Bob Herbert. And I think he's right on the money on that one.
Uh-huh.
So, let's see. We got, where was that?
I read the...
There was another one that...
I read the other one.
Hang on.
Let's see. What else do you have second, folks.
I pulled up the wrong ones here, so hang on.
His article's away.
This one I read it last night, but I feel it's very important to read again because it's really not being covered at all in the news, and it's one of the most frightening things that's happened in the world right now.
A Tale of Two Stories, the European Biowar Outbreak and the Censoring of It by the Mainstream News Media by Rebecca Carley from InfoWars. The biggest story on the planet today is the outbreak of a very serious advanced biological war virus in Europe. The second biggest story on the planet is the suppression of this story for almost 2 weeks by the corporate-owned mainstream news media. There is a lot we know and a lot we can only speculate about what is unfolding in Central Europe. We know that in mid-October, less than a month ago, there was a growing number of cases of what many thought was swine flu in the western part of the Ukraine. We know that hundreds, if not thousands, of people in western Ukraine witnessed low-flying light airplanes, aerosol spraying something over Ukrainian cities during the days of October 29, 2009 and October 31, 2009. We know that beginning the night of October 29th, massive numbers of people began to get very sick. We know that the Ukraine government issued a statement denying that it was doing any aerial spraying to combat the growing disease or authorizing any spraying over Ukrainian cities. We know that by October 30th, the Ukrainian authorities closed all of its schools for 3 weeks and banned public gatherings. We do not know what disease the people were or are coming down with. We do know that doctors are describing the disease as pneumonic plague or some type of hemorrhagic fever or as a hemorrhagic influenza or a hemorrhagic pneumonia. We know that the illness, whatever it is, does not appear to be H1N1. We do know if the disease is a recombination of H1N1 with other viruses or some totally different virus, or if it is a fact, a virus at all. We know that the World Health Organization has had several days to sequence the genes of the disease, but has failed to release this data. We know that the WHO has not called for the quarantining of the Ukraine or the shutdown of all global travel to and from the area of infection. That this is the same thing that they did when Mexican swine flu first broke out, and that failure to contain that virus early on ensured its spread throughout the world. We know that the internal temperature of the lungs of those with a terminal case of what many are calling Ukraine plague is often from 130 degrees Fahrenheit to 135 degrees Fahrenheit. We do know that autopsies show that the lungs are filled with blood and a blackened color and that lung tissue has turned to mush. We knew that the patients who first show any signs of illness usually crash in less than 48 hours, sometimes the same day. We know that the disease was spreading by about 200,000 per day, but this has slowed to about 100,000 a day now in the Ukraine. As people take extraordinary steps to contain the spread of the disease, we know that well over one in a third million people in the Ukraine are very ill with the disease, and that over 60,000 are hospitalized in serious to critical condition. We know that the disease has a very high transmission rate with a likely low amount of viral material needed to cause an infection. We know that the official reports of death are under 300 in the Ukraine. We also know that it is normal for hospital admissions of people with acute respiratory infection to have a fatality rate of 5 to 10%. We know that no official sources were reporting over 3,000. We know that non-official sources were reporting over 3,000 deaths several days ago, and that this number is more in tune with the 5 to 10% fatality rate that the officials figure. We do not know what effective treatments are for this illness. We do know that young adults seem to be more in danger of this illness. We suspect that cytokine storming similar to that in the 1918 Spanish flu that killed approximately 50 million people is taking place. We know from official Ukrainian Health Ministry reports that the illness does not test out as Mexican swine flu. We do not know if the existing swine flu vaccine has any effect, but based on the non-positive response to swine flu in testing, we suspect that the vaccine is ineffective as the viral protein shell is different in H1N1. We know that the illness has spread to Poland, where over 250,000 people are now very ill. We know that it has spread to Belarus and to Hungary and elsewhere in Central Europe. We know that 900,000 people are said to have swine flu in Norway, but we do not know if this is related to the Ukraine plague in any way. We know that on November 8th, the South African site carried the following. Suspicious aircraft were forced to land a U.S.-operated, Russian-made, long-range heavy transport, AN-124, changed its call sign from civilian to military, which then triggered a response from the Indian Air Force upon entering Pakistani airspace. The plane to land in Mumbai, while a second one was forced down by Nigerian fighter jets that also arrested the crew. According to the report, China's People's Liberation Army Air Force contacted the Indian and Nigerian intelligence officials about the presence of these U.S.-operated Ukrainian aircraft amidst growing concern that the United States was spreading biological agents in the Earth's atmosphere, which some Chinese officials believe to be an attempt to commit mass genocide via the spread of H1N1 swine flu. The aircraft were carrying waste disposal systems that could spray up to 45 kilograms.
45,000.
Oh, 45,000 kilograms, nearly 100,000 pounds of aerial type mist from sophisticated nanopipes in the plane's wings called chemtrails. We know that Baxter International Pharmaceuticals sent 72 kilos of human influenza H3N2 vaccine materials to 16 labs in European nations which contain live H5N1 bird flu viruses. We know that this was only discovered when a Czech lab tested the material on several ferrets.
Ferrets have a similar respiratory system to humans.
Yeah.
And all of the ferrets died in short order. We know that Baxter claimed that this was human error. We also know that such a human error is basically impossible with the contaminant protocols in place of Baxter and any other modern biolabs using biosafety levels 3 lab technology. We know that in mid-August, a Joseph Mosch, who is a Mossad biological warfare expert, called into Dr. A. Truot's national radio show and reported that Baxter was getting ready to release a deadly plague from its Ukrainian lab and that he was shortly meeting with U.S. attorneys in Los Angeles to give evidence about this. We also know that shortly thereafter, Mosch was apprehended by FBI agents and L.A. police and taken to the Israeli consulate. We know that he was quickly flown to Israel and that no further word has come from him. We know that over the last 3 or so years, a large number of biological experts from a number of places all over the world have died strange deaths, and that this has been commented on by various publications in the past. So they're killing off the guys who are trying to tell us.
Uh-huh.
Trying to inform the country, the world, that they're planning biological weapon attacks on, you know, different countries and populations, and they've been doing it all along. We know that sudden appearance of Mexican swine flu virtually had to have been a release from a biological warfare lab, and we know that H1N1 has gene sequences from 3 different types. Did you read this? Swine flu of 2 types of human seasonal flu and of Spanish flu, and that such a recombination is so unlikely in nature as to be virtually impossible. We know that WHO, or the World Health Organization, policies of not requiring a major quarantine of Mexico assured that H1N1 would spread throughout the world. We know that the current swine flu vaccine is almost totally untested and that the manufacturers are protected from lawsuits for even deliberate acts that result in deaths, and that nations requiring the vaccines are required to sign contracts agreeing to release negative information on the vaccines to the public. We know that published additives to the vaccine include highly dangerous to human health substances. We know that the corporate-owned mainstream news media, with strong links to global banking families, have censored this story in a way that has never happened before. And we know that the outbreak of unknown but deadly and very rapidly spreading disease in Europe is the largest story on Earth, but that it is not being reported on.
Except by alternative people like you.
Except by us. And I have to ask people to please, if they're listening to the show, mention it to your friends. Mention the show to your friends. Tell them about this article. Go to Infowars.com, A Tale of Two Stories, the European Biowar Outbreak. You might want to check out Google for the Ukrainian plague, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You might want to check that out. Just go in and look it up. And by all means, look these things up.
Read the articles and check it out for yourself.
Don't take our word for it. It's on Infowars.com. And also, go to Global 2000 Report. Google that report up, and you will see exactly what we're talking about here. That report was sponsored by the United States government, Jimmy Carter, in 1976, and signed off by and completed in by Reagan in 1981. All right, so check it out, and it's about human population reduction and how they intend to do it, how it's going to be done, and why? Because they're afraid of the planet being overpopulated, which is a crock of crap. All right. So anyway, victims of virus in Bukova, 22 people at the age of 20 to 40 died, not from bilateral pneumonia, as was previously thought, but as a result of viral distress syndrome, the total destruction of the lungs. At first, the cardiopulmonary insufficiency comes, and consequently cardiogenic shock is developed, which causes cardiac standstill and death, told the Chief Bureau of Regional Forensic Examination, Doctor of Science. During a bilateral pneumonia, some morphological picture is observed. As a data of deaths, there is no such metamorphological picture. The virus, which causes death, is very aggressive. It does not strike the trachea, but immediately gets into the lungs and causes heavy swelling and solid hemorrhage. Mixed types of para-influenza and influenza N1N1 lead to this state. This is a very toxic strain, which has not yet answered to the treatment of the Ministry of Health, said Viktor Bakhtinsky. According to him, there is need to change the treatment standards because those which were used earlier resulted in nothing. Doctors failed to save all people infected with the virus in the reanimation. The belt ventilators did not help also. For this reason, a group of professors from the medical university appeared to appeal to the Ministry of Health and the National Security and Defense Council, which, with a demand to review the standards and treatments of patients in Bukovina. Scientists, morphologists sent to Kiev reports, studies and analysis of critically ill patients and people who died of the virus. Viktor Bakhtinsky noted that the virus is extremely toxic. It is able to penetrate not only through respiratory apparatus, but also through the eyes. And Chernovsky scientists recommend, in any case, use masks and even wear protective spectacles. In an important condition to prevent deterioration of the situation is also the observance of quarantine regime. The Ministry of Health does not consider it as necessary to publish data on the number of confirmed cases of influenza in the laboratory. Ukraine is in the N1N1 influenza pandemic, and now it does not matter how many of these cases we have detected. We should treat everybody equally, said Deputy Minister of Health in a briefing on Friday. this other guy, and don't ask me to pronounce his name, it's incredibly long, also reminded that in Ukraine, since the beginning of the epidemic, 125 MN people, beginning of the epidemic, 125 million people became ill with pandemic influenza and acute respiratory diseases, including 61,000 people over the last of the past day, which is by 8,500 less than the previous day. 65,615 people are treated in the hospital, including 392 in the reanimation and 60 are artificial pulmonary ventilation. Since the beginning of the epidemic in Ukraine, 239 people have died, including 26 people during the last day. Most of them are in the certain regions of the country. And we are also said that the, according to the laboratory data, 14 people died of the pandemic influenza, Interfax Ukraine reports. To date, swine flu in Ukraine is dominant but not the only strain, said the head of the mission of the World Health Organization in Ukraine. They said that the strain of pandemic virus is detected in 22. It goes on and on and on and on. Besides Californian flu in Ukraine, there is a large number of varieties of acute respiratory viral diseases and many other viruses that infect the respiratory system. Genocide is now on being fast-tracked, as promised by the murderous cabal controlling the world. And lastly, after people have asked me why I did not have a PayPal button on my site for people to make donations, I don't know what that.
Well, anyway, we'll come to the end of our interview.
Yeah, so anyway, go to Infowars.com and read the whole article. Tell your friends about it. Know that it's probably the most important. We should have started the show off with this. I'm sorry we didn't, but...
We'll do better in the future.
Yeah, but anyway...
we're ready for our interview with Larry Dorman.
With Larry Dorman.
And he's going to talk about healthcare, some issues pertinent to Connecticut. They could be pertinent to your state, too.
He's the public relations coordinator for AFSCME Union.
Council 4.
Yeah, Council 4.
Located in New Britain, Connecticut.
There you go. Hey, so we're going to have that now, and hope you enjoy it.
Cut back, so you're not making as much money as you did before. So it's really tough for the middle class, and a lot of people are struggling. Hey, Larry, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you? How are you?
We're good. How are you doing?
Fantastic.
Oh, great. I was just mentioning to the folks at home that if you have a stock portfolio, you're probably pretty happy today, but Main Street and beyond isn't as happy. Economic recovery hasn't hit them yet.
No, it's not. That's a big problem. But clearly, working class people, middle class families, lower income families are falling behind, and that also ties into the continuing health care reform saga. Many people who are suffering with out-of-pocket costs for health care, who can't afford the treatment, they're working people, they're employed, but they don't have good insurance, if they have any insurance at all, so there's still a lot of troubling signs in the economy.
Yeah, I think so. When you look at the unemployment rates, they're quite high. And what about the people that are off the books? I mean, if the unemployment rate of the people that we're recording is about 12 or
10.2 or more.
And then if you just kind of speculate the people that are off the books, it's probably another 8 or 9% more. That's very scary.
Absolutely. The true unemployment rate would be much higher when people exhaust their 26 weeks of benefits and any extension they might have. They essentially fall off the face of the earth.
I saw 17.8 or something was their estimated number of people off. If you include all the people off that have expired their unemployment benefits. And those who are on
say
now.
That, Leo, I haven't heard that number, but
yeah,
we represent AFSCME Council 4. We represent many state employees, including those who work at the Department of Labor in the unemployment claims area, as well as the job center. And then, we represent the people who work in the call centers where they process people trying to call in and
yep.
Help them collect their rifle benefits. And certainly from what they tell me, the unemployment figures would be much higher, are much higher when you factor.
Gary.
Well, I saw that particular one, I believe, on CNN about a week ago.
Mm.
Right, when they were talking about the rising, invisible unemployed,
Absolutely, that's a good word for it.
Yeah, and there was estimates that were done. Legitimate ones. I believe they were done at 17.8 was the highest that they figured.
But it's really difficult to factor in here as well. Is it's troubling. Is I've heard the phrase used, and maybe some economists originated it, but the troubling turn of words, but a jobless recovery, that even if we're pulling out of the doldrums a little bit and we're seeing improvements in the stock market, et cetera, that whatever happens now and into the future, we're looking at a jobless recovery, which is awfully frightening.
You know what frightens me? It's like a top-down recovery, which doesn't seem to be right.
I heard for the first time the other day from some economist on someplace that it was a V-shaped recession.
Yeah, you may have seen that in the clippings we put out.
There, the V-shape? Yeah. V-shaped recovery or whatever it was?
Yeah, and it's economist speak, but in the end,
no,
I think what we're looking at is that we just don't seem to have, you don't seem to see the job creation that's needed.
And that really has been historically the yardstick to measure the wealth of a country, is the employment and the productivity of its workers. So that's very troubling.
It is. And American workers statistically are incredibly productive. We're working faster, harder, more efficiently, but unfortunately we're also working for less.
Yeah. Yep.
But again, it's awfully troubling when you hear about the economy starting to turn around, and not that that's troubling, but when you hear that phrase, a jobless recovery, it seems to me that the best anti-poverty program is gainful employment, where people have some disposable income, can spend money in their
jobs. Right.
Why are the, you must know this, or at least suspect, but why is there suddenly a 20 and 30% increase in health insurance? Okay, across the board, everyone's getting, these enormous increases in health insurance premiums.
Why the increase?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, I mean, has health costs gone up 20% over the last year?
Costs are skyrocketing. One place it hasn't skyrocketed premium costs are the state employee health plan, as I've mentioned to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's an example of a program that's working because there's a labor management health care cost containment committee. The insurance providers are held accountable. They can't jack up their premium costs. Aetna went to the insurance industry went to the and the Blue Cross, I should say, went to State Insurance Commission looking for a 32% increase on their plans in Connecticut. And that ever-friendly insurance department didn't give them 32%. They gave them
20%.
Mm-hmm. So to hear that number.
Are you there?
Hello? I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, you're still there? We thought maybe something happened to you.
Yeah, you muted yourself out there, I think.
So at any rate, the insurance, certainly on the administrative side, insurers are being granted huge rate increases.
Mm-hmm.
And look, there are costs. It's a costly system, and part of this debate that's happening in Washington is about how to rein in some of those costs and make medical delivery more efficient, have electronic records, avoid duplication. Certainly, it's an expensive system, but again, idealistic. But the state employee plan had a 0% increase in fiscal year 7-8 because labor management actually are able to
not only hold insurance, their insurance provider accountable, but we emphasize prevention. There are a lot of communications go out to state workers about getting checkups and getting prostate exams and so on after age 50. Prescription drugs for state employees are lower generally than the public pays, and that's because our co-insurance, our members' co-insurance has increased significantly. State employees pay quite a bit into their plans, contrary to the myth that some of our right-wing enemies put out. So state employees pay a lot out of pocket, but where we negotiated with the state, making sure that state employees got the medicine they needed, the prescription drugs that they needed to stay healthy, the maintenance drugs. And that's an important part of the debate, and maybe a lesson we can learn, because the costs are escalating and premium costs certainly are.
But where is this justified? How are they justifying these cost increases? From the hospitals? From the doctors are getting 20% increases? Hospitals are getting 20-25% increases?
The question, quite frankly, Leo and Lyle, is that the I don't dispute that there are cost increases. I don't dispute that it's an expensive system. But I think that the only people who are really, the people who are primarily and heavily profiting from the system are insurance companies.
The paper people in the middle. I was looking at the Ask Me legislative report.
Yep.
And 39 Democrats voted against the health care bill.
That's correct.
One of them being someone whom I really like a lot, and that's Dennis Kucinich of Ohio.
It was interesting when I heard that.
And I listened to his justification of that, and I was wondering what you think about it. He felt, and I happen to agree with him, I supported a single payer. That's what I want, a single payer health plan. He felt that this was just another giveaway to insurance companies, and he felt it was too costly. That was his thinking behind it. He's always wanted a single-payer plan, and he feels that we can still get one.
Not only that, the Pelosi plan, you know, intends to mandate that everybody pay for an insurance policy upwards of $15,000 per head. Okay, and at the same time, Larry, if they don't pay for it, they'll be fined and possibly imprisoned. I read this the other night on the air. I couldn't believe it.
But it's very much like what's in place in Massachusetts. You have to have health care.
Right. It's,
but I mean, if a guy's unemployed, okay, and can't afford health care, all right, how the hell is what? They're going to come down and fine the guy too? And put him in jail?
No. You're misunderstanding that part, Leo.
No, I read it, Lila.
That's not exactly how it works. First of all, let's let Larry respond to my question about Dennis Kucinich. Do you think it's possible, you understand the pulse of the political situation better than we do around this health care thing?
Oh, you're pretty good. I wouldn't appreciate
your kindness, but... Do you think that there's any possibility that a single payer could ever make it in the way the things are today?
I'm hesitating to answer. I think you know why. That's the system I would like to see.
That's what you'd like to
see. I think
that
it's slim to none none in the lead. It's very difficult in this peculiar culture, political, economic culture of ours, to achieve that. We've had so many useful discussions and productive discussions on this show about single payer, and I know that three of us are in agreement that it would be best.
Yeah.
I've heard experts from Canada, such as Barbara Byers from the Canadian Labor Congress, tell our AFSCME members about the fact that a union-made car from the Canadian auto workers there's about $250 in extra additional cost built in on the health and pension liability on the part of the Canadian auto workers union members, and it's about $1,500 in climbing in this country. So what I've heard is that the single payer system in Canada actually makes the climate competitive for business.
Right.
Everybody's competing on the same level ground because government is involved. So, you know, my heart would like to see this. My head is saying I don't think it's going to happen in our lifetimes, yours or mine, which is why
You've got this rather complicated and complex piece of legislation, an issue being debated in Washington because, and God bless Dennis Kucinich for what he's saying and what he feels. I think that, but I think representatives, great people like Joe Courtney from Connecticut's 2nd District understand that we need the single payer, but it's not going to happen. So let's fight for as much as we can short of that. And I think that's what's sort of animating the debate.
Yeah.
I can't get in Kucinich's mind. I certainly like a lot of his positions, but maybe that's where he's coming from.
Yeah, he just really feels that that's the way to go, and when I heard him speak, it was just a very short segment.
I read his reply.
To that.
I don't think we're going to see a single-payer system.
No, probably not. Huh?
You know, private corporate money so influences and stains political process. I will say this, and it's no shock or surprise to hear me say it. If you had a true campaign finance reform, and if you took all this rotten lobbying, corporate lobbying money out of the system, yes, I think we could achieve a single-payer system.
Yeah.
But when insurance companies and allied organizations and the Chamber of Commerce and big business are spending so much money in D.C. to lobby against this, it's very difficult for me to envision this happening.
Well, I think one of the biggest culprits in this is Obama himself. I mean, his campaign promise was to do away with lobbyists. There won't be lobbyists within a mile from the White House. And, correct, his entire cabinet and his advisory staff are lobbyists. All right? And the lobbyists have spent more money in the last year. Okay? Again, you know, the Wall Street lobbyists, the insurance lobbyists have spent more money on Congress this year than they probably have in the last 10.
Right.
I mean, you know.
So from that standpoint, you know, he's been a bit of a disappointment. I wanted him to speak a little more strongly on his position on health care. And I felt that he stepped away from that a bit.
And you know that Goldman Sachs was his largest campaign donor?
Yeah. But anyway.
Imagine that.
You mentioned that.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that. Not that I doubt what you're saying.
That's correct. Largest personal campaign donor.
Right.
But to get to the health care bill that we could maybe live with. Maybe it's not the one we want, but one that we could live with. I'm concerned, as I know, AFSCME is the suggestion that because we as a union have worked so hard to get health care benefits for our members, that they could tax those benefits.
Correct. That is one thing, and I can't imagine AFSCME and other unions supporting reform, because to us that would be a variation.
Okay, I'm at the end of that. Hold on one second. Okay, well, I'm not. I guess I had a problem with my tape turn. I've tried so many times to, I'm trying to digitalize these interviews, and unfortunately it's taking a long time because of the problems at the station on Tuesday nights. Because of the equipment is not geared up to digitalize these this particular I guess there's not enough space on the hard drive on that specific computer, so I have to unfortunately tape these on tape and record them they do have an older system, and we're trying. Hopefully, they'll update it. But since they don't, we're one of the few talk shows on. There's only three talk shows on that station, actually. One morning show, and they don't really record the their programming. It's mostly they don't record their talk shows. Unfortunately, it's not. It's a needed. Mine is the only talk show that's recorded in that station, and we apologize for this archaic system, but it's the way that it is. But If you were listening to this, or if you just joined us, we had Larry Dorman from Astro Union discussing the healthcare and so on vote. And it is an abomination as far as I'm concerned. And Dennis Kucinich was the only one of the only congressmen who did not vote for the healthcare bill because he felt that it was totally an inappropriate bill. It just was so gutted that it didn't do any good for anybody. He was advocating the single health payer healthcare, and as we, Lila and I, of course, are as well. We feel that anything less is really more of a joke and just an appeasement, you know, to the insurance companies. Quite frightening, actually, what's going on. So, in the meantime, I'm trying to piece this tape together, so I might be able to get the interview back, but fortunately, I have a snag here. But if you hold on, I might be able to repair this. But in the meantime, we feel, or especially I do, and I know Lila does as well, but we feel that the whole situation with this health care bill is just an absolute joke. I mean, there is no reading the other night. I think I read it on a show last week. I'm not positive, but in this bill, as it was proposed by the House and Nancy Pelosi, the darling of the Congress, they're going to demand that everybody have health care, but those that can't afford it or won't pay for it will be subject to a fine of up to $250,000 and a 5-year prison sentence if they don't have health insurance. Now you tell me, folks, if this is becoming what kind of a system this is, and this is insane. I mean, that they would impose a $250,000 fine on somebody who refuses to have health insurance. I mean, there's something more going on here, and that doesn't make sense. Now, there's also there was a warning that came out. And it's been stated in a number of places that they are planning, in the bill, provides for a mandatory, that in the vaccine, there will actually be a microchip. Yes, that's right. And staggeringly, people are going to be paying for this. I mean, to have this done to them. In this vaccine, and I think I'm beyond repair here for this particular tape. It's gotten crooked and can't be turned around for some reason. Excuse me, but I'm going to try to. In the meantime, unfortunately, I don't think I can recuperate this tape, repair this tape for tonight's program, and I have to leave it at that. But I wanted to mention that since we only got a few minutes left, I'm going to go to a website that we can. This up. I don't know if it can or not. I thought I had it bookmarked here, but I guess not. guess we're going to have to end the show here. I can't play the remainder of that interview. I apologize. Before I go, there's one more article I thought I might read before we end the program. And again, please don't forget. Mention the European biowar outbreak in the Ukraine. It's absolutely devastating. They were sprayed by a bioweapon, H1N1, very, 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 very frightening stuff. And almost have over 1.2 million people have been affected by it. They've come down with it. Much upwards of 100,000 people a day are being infected with it. And this stuff is turning people's lungs into mush, okay? And they're dying. It's an absolutely horrendous thing that's going on, and it was done by the United States. The United States had, and Baxter Pharmaceutical were the ones who produced this agent, and they have an outlet in the Ukraine. And it was put on to these huge tankers and chemtrailed over the major cities, and that's been recorded. It's noted, it's known, and it is not being reported in the United States mainstream media, and I haven't heard it on the BBC or any of the other major news outlets other than a few alternative groups and some and the Ukrainian press, the Ukrainian press, yeah. So, please look that up. You might want to go into Ukrainian bioweapons or Ukrainian pneumatic plague, Ukrainian plague. That'll get you to there. And, that's it. There's one other small article I wanted to read, and it's really quite devastating. And it's regarding the UN investigator accuses the U.S. of shameful neglect of the homeless. UN special reporter says wealthy U.S. ignoring deepening homeless crisis while pumping billions into bank rescues. The UN special reporter Raquel Rolnick says the burden falls most heavily on the very poor, and leaving the extent of the housing crisis invisible to many of the U.S. The United Nations special investigator was blocked from visiting the U.S. by the Bush administration, has accused the American government of pouring billions of dollars into rescuing banks and big business while treating an invisible and deepening homeless crisis. Raquel Rolnick, the U.N. special reporter for the right to adequate housing, who has just completed a seven-city tour of America, said it was shameful that a country as wealthy as the U.S. Was not spending more money on lifting its citizens out of homelessness and substandard, overcrowded housing. The housing crisis is invisible for many in the U.S., she said. I learned through this visit that real affordable housing and poverty is something that hasn't been dealt with as an issue. Even if we talk about the financial crisis and governments stepping in order to promote economic recovery, there is no such helpless help for the homeless. She added, I think those who are suffering the most in this whole situation are the very poor, the low-income population, and the burden is disproportionately on them, and it's of course disproportionately on African Americans, on Latinos and immigrant communities, and on Native Americans. Rolnick toured Chicago, New York, Washington, Los Angeles, and Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania town, where this year the first four sheriff sales, public auctions of seized property in the country included 498 foreclosed properties, or 598 foreclosed properties. She also visited a Native American reservation. The U.S. government does not tally the numbers, but interested organizations say that more than 3 million people were homeless at some point over the past year. The fast-growing segment of the homeless population is families with children, often single parents. On any given night in Los Angeles, about 17,000 parents and children are homeless. Most will be found in a place in a shelter, but many single men and women are forced to sleep on the streets. Los Angeles, which is described as the homeless capital of America, has endured an 18-fold increase in housing foreclosures. Evictions from owned and rented homes have risen about tenfold, with 62,400 people forced out last year in Los Angeles County. Welfare payments are not enough to meet the rent, let alone food and other necessities. A single person on welfare living in Los Angeles receives $221 a month, and an amount that hasn't changed in a decade, and the rent for one room is typically nearly double that. Rolnick said that while she saw difficult conditions in all the places she visited, the worst was on the Native American reservation of Pine Ridge in South Dakota. You see, total hopelessness, despair, very bad conditions. Nothing I have seen in other cities compared to the physical condition of the housing at Pine Ridge. Nothing compared to the overcrowding. They're not visible. They're isolated. They're far away. They're just lost, she said. Rolnick says that one of the greatest matters of shame is that the U.S. has the resources to provide decent housing for everyone. In the U.S., it's feasible to provide adequate housing for all. You have a lot of money, a lot of dollars available. You have a lot of expertise. This is a perfect setting to really embrace housing as a human right, she said. And Rolnick has given a verbal report to the U.S. State Department, which has a month to respond to her observations. She will submit a final report to the U.N. Human Rights Council early next year. So be ready for that one, folks. That will be an interesting one. But that's the case of the truly homeless, and it's a sad situation because it exists here, and we know that, and we see it in every city in the country. And towns, and it's quite sad. So and it's very real. So the show's ended. I apologize for the mess up there with the tape, but that hasn't happened in quite a while. But I want to thank you and for joining me, and join me tomorrow night as I read chapter 7 and possibly 8 of my latest book. Naked at the Mic, The Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril. And hope you enjoy it. I'm glad I noticed the readership has been increasing. Our listenership has been increasing, and we're very grateful to that. We just crossed over the 40,000 listener mark, and since we've been on, and that's wonderful for the for an internet show, I think. And of course, we do very well. Also, if you happen to be on Facebook, you can get our show there. We're loaded. You can go to Leo Steele, all right, the L.A. Steele Show. Go to my Facebook page there. And, you know, if you're interested, if you are a Facebook member, I'd be happy to sign on as one of your friends. Just send me an invite, and I want to thank everybody for listening. And again, join me tomorrow night right here at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard, and I will we'll be doing chapter 7, which is Jesus was a liberal. That's chapter 7. So I hope you enjoyed the show, and